You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 56 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht.
And I'm Jessica Van Dam.
And today I'm savouring it's called fruit and nut, but like I think it's just the label I've given it. I'm not sure it's the original flavour of the tea, but it's very good and it's very nutty and fruity. And it reminds me slightly of that tea that you bought me ages ago, Jess, that I absolutely loved, but then they went out of business and then we haven't since been able to find an equivalent tea that's as good. And that's the highest bar that I have for tea is that tea that you bought me ages ago.
Oh my God, I wish I remembered which one. Because there was either the one when I worked at a coffee shop.
It was that one.
Okay. Yeah. Was it the pistachio one?
No, I think it was candied almonds or something.
Oh yeah. That was like a seasonal one too. So we didn't even have that forever. It was just like a limited edition.
Oh, and it was so
And so
good.
I continue looking for nutty
same.
Teas.
Oh, same. Yeah. Every so often I'm like, ooh, and that one. And this is the closest I've found. But anyway, yes.
We just got to start making teas, I guess.
I kind of want to try making different like fruity teas. So the teas without tea leaves.
Yeah, like a tisane.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's see. Anyway, so yes, that's what I'm savoring today.
And I have, so this is also a long-winded answer. So Harney & Sons did a Rosebud Motel limited edition tea. Ooh. And so it's the continental breakfast and it's cinnamon caramel vanilla black tea.
Wow. And there's no rose in it though.
No, it's just from Schitt's Creek. I don't know if you ever saw that. But.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, that does sound good. Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
I recommend. Oh. It is lovely. It's kind of like a little dessert, but tea. Mm.
That's my favorite kind of teas is those ones that just make you go, even though now it's been horribly hot here today, the summer is starting in earnest. And so it was difficult to drink a tea, but it's actually quite nice and cool in my office. So it's fine. I can have my tea.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. The owner of the yarn shop that I go to, Ruth, she texted me. She's like, so you're recording today. What tea are you drinking? Will it be hot? Will it be iced? These are the questions we want to know. And I was like, oh, that's a really good question, Ruth. It's gray outside, so I think it will be hot. Maybe. And then as soon as I said that, the temperature rose like 10 degrees. And I was like, well, I'm still sticking with hot tea. I can't switch now.
Well, apparently it's this whole thing. So every Inuit Nook person, I should say, that I spoke to believes that the whole way that food and sort of heat regulation system works in the body is that if you eat cold food, then you'll warm up. And if you eat warm food, then you will cool down because it's changing the like internal versus external heat levels. So that's why, according to your average Nook person, you should even eat frozen food in the winter because that will warm you up because your body will try to warm itself up in relation to the cold food that's coming in.
And I feel like that relates to the like spicy food being eaten on like around the equator where it's hottest.
Yeah.
Like there's just so many spicy cuisines that.
I should, by the way, point out that this is not something that we've researched. And this is not something that either of us have any kind of knowledge about. So do not take this as read. This is purely what we've heard and our own speculation. Yes. So anyway.
We're now experts on food. No.
Yeah, right. Not. You know, there you go. Just this is now a podcast about different food temperatures. But that's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is the first in a little mini series that we're going to do about everyday archaeology of cutlery. Because, well, it's kind of related to food, actually, right? A lot of the time.
It all ties, in my opinion.
Right? You know, it's all related. But yes, so this is part of my... So those of you who are new to Tea Break Archaeology, welcome, first of all. And quite a lot of what we cover in this is sort of fun facts, cozy archaeology, so to speak, which is a little phrase that we've just kind of made up. And everyday archaeology. So, you know, everyday items that are just laying around your house. What is the actual history of it? What is the archaeology of it? Where does it come from? Why has it become so important to us today? So we thought cutlery is a good place to look at next. So today we're going to be looking at what I would argue is the quintessential piece of cutlery that has been it's quite often counted as the earliest tool type, but we're going to talk about this because preservation bias plays a huge role in that, but it is knives. So the knife, the simple knife, which I'm curious, the first thing that sort of came to your mind initially when you thought of a knife, what was it?
It's weird. Mm-hmm. Because you don't usually associate like food with like, I don't know, armed attack.
I mean, I guess not. But and that's interesting, actually, because according to the Cambridge Dictionary, which complete side note, before this recording started, I thought, oh, let's look up the official dictionary definition of a knife. And I immediately went to the Oxford English Dictionary. In order to look up stuff on the Oxford English Dictionary in detail, you now need to have a subscription and register. Oxford English Dictionary, if you're listening, that is gatekeeping of the highest degree, and I do not approve. And I even tried to sign up and register, and then I signed up, and then it wouldn't let me sign in. Anyway, point being, we're on Cambridge Dictionary now, and they let us in, and they gave us a full definition. So there you go. Anyway, if anyone can think of, by the way, a good dictionary that they would recommend, please do get in touch and let us know. But yes, according to the Cambridge Dictionary, knife is a noun, plural knives, which is a tool usually with a metal blade and a handle used for cutting and spreading food or other substances, or as a weapon. So, you know, side note, weapon. Which, so, you know, you're not wrong. That's apparently the classic definition of a knife, is cutlery and weapon. So,
I mean, I feel like historically it should have been like weapon cutlery, but I don't know.
Well, this is what we're going to get into. So Interesting for me, the first thing that I thought of was pen knives, like multi-purpose tools. And you always have a little knife. Yeah. Because it sounds a bit weird to say it out loud. I was slightly obsessed with pen knives when I was younger. And my best anecdote is when we used to live in France. And we had gone to this really cool market and they had a beautiful stall selling knives. They were selling these, and I remember the brand. It was L'Aiguille or something. I can't remember exactly how you say it, but L'Aiguille, which are these beautiful knives, and they come with beautiful handles, and they're like a sort of, they almost look like an elvish blade, you know? They're really nice. And I got it, a little knife, and that was my treat. That was my birthday present. And we were driving to the UK, and so we were going on the ferry, and Dad had stopped and got out. I was like 10 or 11, and Dad had stopped to get petrol. He'd gotten out the car to fill up the car, and I was, you know, opening the knife, and I closed it on my finger. Luckily, it didn't go that deep, but it went quite deep. And so Dad came back in from the petrol, and I was just covered in blood and like had loads of tissues. I was going, I've had a bit of an accident. And we were literally about to get on the ferry, like with all of our stuff, with our dog, like and everything, to go over to the UK. And I was like, we don't have time to sort this. Let's just wrap it up. So I had like my finger was about the size of my hand with all the wrapping of the tissues and then just like sellotape around it and everything. Anyway, point being, I was not allowed a pen knife for a year or two after that. Because, fair enough.
Do you still have that knife, or was that?
You know what? I think Mum might have stolen it, and I think she might.
Oh, fair enough.
But I have a better one now, so it's okay.
Okay.
Anyway, but knives in general, I think, is quite interesting because you've just pointed out that, like, a knife is not even necessarily like, what is a knife? How does one define a knife? We have the dictionary definition, but you just pointed out that, like, actually, was it a weapon first, or was it a, you know, random knife first?
Or would you classify it more as like a tool and then it was a weapon?
Yeah. Is a weapon a tool? I mean.
Right. I mean, that's kind of a reasonable question.
Yeah. And would it have been then like a multi-purpose tool? So, you know, your table knife was just like the knife that you happened to carry around, and that was your like cutting tool. And then you also used it for, you know, being at the table.
I mean, historically, that's what I read that's how it's like kind of started.
Yeah, because it was
you had one on you at all times, and then you just brought it to whatever table you were at. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is that, of course, our definition of what a knife is relatively modern in terms of it being an eating utensil or, I mean, a weapon, but, you know, and that sort of idea of it having to be a metal blade and all that kind of stuff. So actually, if we're looking for the earliest record of a knife, like what is the history of knives? What is the earliest evidence that we have for knives? It's very difficult because our definition of the word is so modern that if you're looking for references to it, you need to be kind of careful about what you're looking for. So both Jess and I had a little look and saw to see if we could try and find the oldest kind of historic reference, so written source, for a knife. So what did you come across in your research, Jess?
I came across Sumerian and Egyptian written accounts of bronze or copper blades. We should also clarify that bronze is a copper alloy, but anyway.
Yeah.
So it does contain copper, but it was more records of like trade of those knives, swords. Mm-hmm. And then there's references to them on like decorative walls, which is to say you
right?
see
which,
with, like.
But that's also indeed that thing, right? Because it's like, how do we interpret those pictures? Like,
yeah, exactly.
We look at them and go, oh, it's a knife. But maybe they were like, ah, yes, it's a, I don't know, a tool for spreading butter. Or probably not. But,
yeah. like,
but, or you know.
Maybe it was.
Maybe it was.
Yeah, you're Claxton ready, ritualistic.
Yeah. Oh, I don't have the Claxton for this one.
It's no!
My trowel.
No! We need another Claxton.
Actually, you know what? I can probably access it. Oh, I can access it.
Ritual.
Yeah,
we're stealing the ritual buzzer from And My Trowel, which is the other podcast with Ash. So that is also Ash in the ritual buzzer, but I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure she won't mind us stealing it for this one. But exactly, yeah, it could be ritual. It could be like a representation of something that means something else, you know? So
yeah,
not exactly the actual item itself. Well, that's kind of similar to what I found. So I also found reference to indeed the records of like the trade or the distribution of copper knives was mainly what I found, because generally copper, the Chalcolithic, came earlier than the Bronze Age. So the ones I found that were most securely dated, like this is definitely some kind of representation of a knife, dates to 2600 to around 2350 BCE. So it's a cuneiform clay tablet from Nippur. So that is the earliest. And there's, we'll put a link in the show notes because you can see it at the Met Museum. They have it there.
That's very cool.
Again, I mean, problem is like translation of cuneiform, you know, you have to use existing vocabulary, etc. So depending on how you translate it depends on then the interpretation that you can make of what they're actually trying to talk about.
Yeah, because it's either like, I feel like it's either between like a cutting tool or it's like some sort of, again, that weapon.
Yeah.
Concept, yeah. Which I think is different from cutting somehow.
Yeah, I mean, one kind of, indeed, even though it's interesting actually that you're talking about it, like, is a weapon a tool? Because a weapon is a tool, but quite a lot of the time, the weapons that we see were also used, were used more lightly as tools. Like, if you think of an axe as well, I would say, like, you can have like battle axes, but then an axe is also a tool for chopping wood. So at what point is it a weapon? And at one point, is it a tool?
Right. And I wouldn't like look at a block of cheese and go, ah, my sword, the perfect blade for this.
And but, like, yet, if you had one, let's be honest, wouldn't you be using it to cut that cheese?
I mean, where is the use where analysis for cheese?
Right.
You know?
We don't know. Maybe they were using it to talk to Valerio.
I think Valerio would know.
So that's an interesting point, actually. And have I had Valerio on? Yes, I have had Valerio one, right? Yes, I've had Valerio one. This is the problem when you do so many different podcasts. I'm trying to remember who's been on which one. So I'll find the episode with Valerio and pop it in the show notes. Because, yeah, the episode with our fellow colleague from Leiden University, our old classmate, Valerio Gentile, and he does usewear analysis on bronze swords to see whether they would have been used in combat situations. So,
this would have been perfect.
Right. Wait, Valerio, if you're listening, why aren't you on?
Come on.
You could have told us everything.
But you weren't invited, but...
But also, is a sword a knife?
There's the question.
Yeah.
He would probably say no.
I mean, according to the Cambridge Dictionary, a tool with a metal blade and a handle...
This is true. Know,
technically. And isn't that the whole thing of, you know, oh, you call that a... You call that a knife? This is a knife. But like, then there's also that's not a sword, that's a knife, you know, and all this kind of thing. And it's like, well, there must be a definition difference. I haven't looked that up for this episode. Maybe we can look it up for other episodes.
Cambridge Dictionary says that a sword is a weapon with a long, sharp metal blade and a handle, used especially in the past.
I mean, there's a lot of overlap there.
a lot of overlap.
Which, again, just shows the importance of cataloging and categorization and typologies, because the distinction between knife and sword, one could argue, is a purely superficial one. because both of them include a blade, both of them include a handle. Yes, maybe the intended use is different, but who's to say that a sword was not used to chop down the occasional bush that was in your path or something?
Machetes.
Cut your meat. Yeah, exactly. Maybe you did use it to cut your meat if you didn't have a knife handy. It's all very, subjective and based on how we view the world and what we think of as terms of material categories.
Yeah. Also, maybe size. I could imagine size being a different, differentiating.
There probably is some, that we're going to have a load of sword specialists screaming at us who are listening in going, for goodness sake, don't you know? It's obviously this. Like, there probably is some official category and definition of a sword that refers to specific points that would differentiate it from a knife. We just haven't had to happen to look it up in time for this episode because I did not think that we would go down this rabbit hole of is a sword a knife. But
we should go down a rabbit hole,
right? But maybe this is something we can look up and, we can chat about, and we can post on Instagram or something.
We can have a little corrections corner with Valerio.
Exactly. Sometime. Yeah. Feel free to send us in, if you don't agree with something we say, feel free to send us. Better to send a message directly to one of our email addresses rather than comment on the podcasting platform that you're listening to, because we don't always get notified of all of the comments because we're on a lot of different podcasting platforms. So better to contact us directly, but feel free to if you have any, disagreements, or also if you have any suggestions or references or resources that you think deserve a good dive into, that'd be good. Anyway, should we take a very quick break and top up our tea?
Sounds good.
And then we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Hope the teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So we've chatted a little bit about the problem of definitions and written sources and how does one define a knife? How can we actually tell if someone's referring to a knife or not? So what we're going to go back to is something that is much more solid, much more tangible, and that is the physical evidence for the earliest knives. So
I think this sounds like your thing, Matilda. We're going into stone tools, which are aggressively not my field.
Well, and we did do, so those of you who are interested, there is a episode all about the archaeology of stone tools, which is just a couple of episodes back, so you can just scroll up a little bit and you should be able to see it. And in there I go into a lot of detail about the different stone tool technologies that we had and how our use of stone tool developed over time. But indeed, the oldest physical evidence that we have for a knife is a stone blade. So flint blade specifically, because flint is a very particular type of stone that you find a lot of in especially prehistory, but even in the modern day, it's used quite a lot. Funnily enough, actually, a friend of mine, he uses a flint knife as his pen knife because it's just really easy to take everywhere. And it's one of those things that if you accidentally forget it in the bottom of your bag, it won't go off in a metal detector or anything because it's stone. So I probably shouldn't be saying that on a podcast.
I know, actually. So I was just in Romania for 2 weeks and my friend was flying through Heathrow because she's in the UK. Mm-hmm. And on the way there, she got her little multi-tool through. Oh, no problem. Because she forgot that she had it. Because you do, right? Yeah. So on the way there, no problem. So we had it while we were in Romania, which was great. And then coming back through Romania, they caught it immediately. And they were like, what is this weapon? And she's like, no, my multi-tool.
Oh no.
So Romania, they're strict, I can tell you.
Okay. There we go.
Very intense security.
I mean, which, fair.
It makes me feel better, honestly. But
But it's one of those things. It's so versatile. And the reason that flint is used is because it's have something known as a conchoidal fracture, which basically means that the way that it splits creates these really nice, what we call flakes, which basically become a knife blade. And I will put a link in the show notes to something called the Museum of Stone Tools, which is an online resource, which is very useful for looking up different kinds of stone tools, especially flint tools. They have lots of lovely visualizations on there so that you can have a little look and you can see what I mean by a flake. But yeah, it's a bit difficult to say because, again, what are we classifying as a knife here? According to the Cambridge Dictionary, it's metal with a handle, but would a blade, like a stone blade, not also have the same functionality as what we would classify as a knife?
See, I think it would. I think it should be.
Right? Yeah. So the only thing is, so for example, you have the Lumequian tools, which are from Kenya, which are about 3.3 billion years old. So they're the kind of some of the earliest stone tools that we have. But again, they're usually called, they have a cutting edge, but I wouldn't say they were a knife. I would say they're more, they're always called a stone tool. They're not called like blades or anything like that. Whereas the oldest blades that we have, so these like thin flint pieces that have like a long thin blade on them, known as flakes, is probably the older one culture, which is about 2.6 million years ago. But again, does that count as a knife, etc.? And so if we're talking about with handles on, I had a look and I managed to find there was evidence from some pieces of flint flakes from the site called Campitello Quarry in Italy. And it's a site that's been attributed to Neanderthals. And what's really interesting is that there's birch resin that survived on the edge of these flakes. And birch resin is basically a hafting material, so a kind of sticky glue that was added to a flake. That flake would then be pushed into the end of a stick and then like bound with some kind of cord. And then that was the sort of hafting. That was how it was attached to the handle with this birch resin. So even though, because the problem is the handles, especially this age, so this site is around 200,000 years old. And at that age, it's very rare that organic remains, we've talked about this before, everyone who has listened for a while, we had a whole long conversation about this in the archaeology of clothing episode. Organic remains very rarely survive in the archaeological record because they break down a lot easier. I think I've talked about this with Jess as well, even in like our previous record thing as well. They don't preserve very well in the archaeological record. You have to have very specific conditions for them to preserve. Again, if you're interested, please go and check out the archaeology of clothing episode. And so what you have instead is just the blades that are left. You don't have the handles. But when you see this glue residue, this resin, then that could strongly suggest that they were hafted onto some kind of handle. So
And so you said that the really earliest sort of sharp tool, I think you said it was in Kenya.
Yes, the Mekwia.
Is there any speculation on what those were used for?
They reckon they were probably used for like butchering. So
there is still a cutting, slicing.
Exactly. There's concept. Still that cutting, slicing. But they almost are more like a what's known as like a hand axe. So you basically have a big stone that has a sharpened edge that you have sharpened. Kind of thing. It's what's known as the like the first typology of stone tools. So it's basically like almost, it's called pebble technology sometimes as well. And that's also older one culture, to be fair. But then you start to see something that you could specify as flakes, where it's basically, you still see a lot of the original rock. And then it's just been kind of sharpened around a particular point. Whereas in later periods, in the Acheulean culture, for example, I always say that wrong, by the way, it might be Acheulean. Come for me, whatever. It's like, it's in that one, you're actually like flint napping. So you're actually shaping into something. Mm-hmm. And then you have other ones where you have actual like cores that you're preparing. And that's, for example, like the Levallois technique or things like that, which then you are preparing a particular core that you're then hitting in a particular way to create lots of little blades, which again, I talk about in detail in the Archaeology of Stone Tools episode. But yeah, this is the problem, is that quite a lot of these earlier ones, we don't have that many of them, the really early ones. And B, it's sort of hard because they're so old, it's really hard to do any kind of use wear on them.
Also, I would imagine that if they're, you know, only sharpening one end, it kind of just looks like a rock. And so looking at it, you'd be like, oh, it kind of looks like someone sharpened this, but hard to tell if this is just a rock.
Yeah, especially with the earlier ones, it can be quite hard to tell. I think it's one of those things that comes with experience, you know, like at some point you can tell if it's been intentionally flaked. But it is interesting, actually, even today, I was at work today in my job as a post-excavation archaeologist for a commercial company, and I was working with one of my colleagues and I was kind of teaching her about categorizing stone tools, as luck would have it. And it was interesting because it was some piece of flint. And then she's like, but look, this is like pressure flaking, right? And I was looking, well, no. And she's like, but it looks the same as the other ones. And I was going, well, yes, it does, but like, it's not, because it's got these other things that then look slightly different. And like, it's sort of one of those things that it's like, you have to get your eye in, basically.
Yeah. I specifically did not enjoy studying lithics, so I think I've like repressed a lot of information about them, but this is helpful.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious. So we've talked about stone tools, of course, and everything like that, and the fact that, quite often you won't have things like the handle surviving. If we're going by this Cambridge definition that it has to be some kind of metal tool, there's apparently no kind of, I was trying to look up, and this is something that I want to try and highlight in this podcast as well, is that whenever we're looking these things up, where, you know, we're using the resources that are available to us, neither Jess nor I have institutional affiliation. So we have to also deal with paywalls, and we can only access, you know, open access articles that are free to read and you don't have to pay to read. And so it's very difficult to find a lot of information in that way. But so apparently there doesn't seem to be like a singly recognized, like, this is the oldest copper knife, because a lot of the early copper artifacts, especially that were found, were discovered in like the 19th and early 20th centuries, when, shall we say, the documentation standards were not exactly high quality, aka people found
stuff.
That's
kindly
put. Yeah, right. Mr. Smith found something and was like, oh, this is nice. Oh, yes, I think it was found in this context. It was found near my shed, you know, and that's all the information we have about where it was found. So we know nothing about its context, so we can't really accurately date it. And typology.
Continuing to joke about the largest oak tree on the edge of.
Yeah.
Brown's farm. Or...
Exactly. Yeah, Which is really fun to read sometimes as well, when you read these old like excavation reports, and it's like, it was given by Mr. M, who found it approximately 3 yards from his latest pit, you know, that he dug or something. And you're like, great, wonderful.
Or the neighbor's dog brought it.
Yeah.
And we thought it was just a stick, but it was actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yes. So we're not exactly sure, but what we do know is that archaeologists have found copper knives that date to the Chalcolithic, aka the Copper Age, which is approximately 5000 BC, depending on where you are in the world. Of course, all of these ages, the Chalcolithic, Neolithic, Bronze Age, they change their date range depending on where you are in the world, because different cultures develop different kinds of technologies at different rates and different patterns. So in some places you don't even have a Chalcolithic because they didn't have copper, for example, and things like that. So yes, anyway, that's approximately 5000 BC though, is the kind of oldest copper knives that we have, but we don't know if they are the oldest or if there are potentially older ones. And yeah, it's very difficult to do. And which brings us nicely to the question for you, Jess. I've talked a lot about stuff too, but now it's time for you to talk, because the copper I know nothing about, like, or metal in general, or stone actually, in terms of kind of conservation, from a kind of artifact conservation perspective, what's important to consider when you're dealing with these sorts of objects?
So, I mean, you were talking earlier about how organic materials just don't survive in the archaeological record particularly well. I mean, there are exceptions, obviously.
Yeah.
And you're sort of dry and arid tends to do better with organic materials. Egypt is great. I love how many old things are just like, well, the oldest one is in Egypt. It's like, was it really? Or did we just put it in a desert and hope for the best? So that's just always going to be the sort of context. But that being said, there are certain types of damp environments that are, I think it's anaerobic. I always get those confused. But anyway, there's very little oxygen in the moisture. And so like bog bodies, which I'm sure have come up, and those sort of boggy environments tend to do pretty well.
Yeah,
exactly. They tend to do pretty well. And even metals do pretty okay. So when I was in grad school, we were given some Anglo-Saxon finds to conserve. And so I worked on a cruciform brooch.
Ooh.
Yes, it was very cool. It was probably a woman's, which I was like, yes, this is the best. Tell me more about her. But the iron corroded. And what was really interesting is that it mineralized the textile that it had been holding. And so you could see the weave structure because the fabric had turned basically into iron.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. But it also meant that it was like very delicate and fragile and wanted to stop existing.
Well, because then you can't really, I mean, I guess you can't remove that then, right? Because then it's gone. Or can you somehow remove it and like still preserve the textile while also preserving the or conserving the metal?
You can't unmineralize it, which is unfortunate, because basically all the organic structures have been replaced by minerals.
Okay.
In this case,
like
mostly iron, but basically you can't really unfossilize things in the same way you can't unmineralize things.
You mean Jurassic Park isn't a thing?
It's not a thing yet. I wouldn't put past scientists at any point. But then copper, in this case specifically, it was either straight copper or it was a copper alloy, like bronze. And that survived really well. There was a few spots with, they call it like copper disease, where it's like actively corroding copper. Mm. But you can kind of scrape that off and put a little coating on it. And then it is fine again. Because the nice thing about copper is that it creates a patina. So it creates this like surface coating of itself.
Is that the green that we see?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So that's verdigris. When it turns like a really bright green, that's when it's like an active corrosion site.
Oh,
but if it's just like that mellow, nice, coppery green, that's when it's nice and happy. And yeah. So, so in the case of this brooch, the copper was very happy, but the iron was not. And the copper was not happy where it connected with the iron because they don't like each other. They activate each other. So all of these sort of play into each other, especially when knives were made out of different things. So like if you had a steel blade with like a copper handle, the blade doesn't survive very well, but the handle might, or vice versa, or, you know.
Okay.
So they react to each other.
Very cool. And how about like more precious metals? Like when we start to get later and you have like ones made of silver and gold and things like that.
I mean, gold doesn't corrode. So that's its big claim to fame.
Nice.
It's nice. But the likelihood of having it like a solid gold knife seems low. But it also is very soft as a metal. So it will deform, especially like in a burial context. So then you're, what did this even look like? It's just a mush of gold.
Okay.
With silver, especially like, you know, 18th, 19th, 20th century, you can have solid silver, like cutlery and knives, but a lot of them were plate. So that you're kind of relying on the underlying metal to dictate how the silver is going to behave. Because silver will tarnish and it can corrode, kind of protects it a little bit. And you get it shiny by taking that off and creating like these little like micro scratches. That's what makes silver shiny. And so you're actually damaging silver every time you polish it.
By polishing it. So we should just let it tarnish and that'll be, then we're good.
Then it's fine. Yeah. Okay. Oh, I mean, it doesn't look as nice to be fair, but generally will be
purely subjective. I think tarnished silver looks beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. But if there's like, let's say there's iron underneath the silver plate, that could erode like through the silver. So sometimes when you see like quote unquote silver like flatware or cutlery, it will look like something else. It won't look like silver tarnish. It will look like something else. And that's because of whatever the underlying metal is doing something weird.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Oh, well, there you go. We've sort of learned, we've learned a bit about everything, about all the material. Which I do have a final question for you before we wrap up. When we were researching this, what was your favorite fun fact that you learned about this topic while you were looking up?
That was spoons. I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, my favorite fun fact, back to the actual one, was that in 1669, King Louis XIV of France decreed that all pointed knives on the street could not be used at the dinner table and made it illegal. And then he ordered that all knife points be ground down so that you would only have like blunt tipped knives at dinner, and it reduced violence.
Huh. There you go. So there's a reason we have ground down knives at the dinner table now.
Yeah, your butter knife. You can thank Louis the 14th.
Oh, there you go. That is a fun fact. Which, that wouldn't work because my parents have, I know, a very specific kind of knife which has a really sharp point on the tip. So we wouldn't have been able to use that in 1669. Good to know.
Yeah. But, yeah. Oh. When we try time travel, now you know. Yeah. You have to grind some of your knives, but not all of them.
We have to. Yeah. Okay. It's good to know. Well.
What was yours? Did you have a fun fact?
I unfortunately didn't about this one.
That's okay. I have two for spoons, so we're ready to go.
There we go. We're all good then. So yes, we'll have that for future episodes. But we are running out of time on this particular tea break. And I know that this episode has been kind of all over the place. And that's basically because knives, I mean, we've gone from 3.3 million years ago to 1669. Knives are one of those objects that are just the essence of when we think of a tool and the history of tools for humanity, a knife is usually the first thing that people come up with because it's such an essential part of our toolkit. And it has been since we were, even since before we were actually humans, like before we were Homo sapiens, it's been part of our toolkit. So we haven't really been able to go into like a really deep dive of how exactly knives went from being that random bit of stone that was used to hack at a carcass to becoming something that had to be ground down to be used at the dinner table safely. And that's frankly because there's just so much that happens in between. There's 3.3 million years that happens in between. And
yeah,
it's hard to go into detail on all of that. But
I was joking with Matilda as we were doing research for this. And I was like, excuse the Wikipedia articles that I am referencing because I don't even know where to start with knives. This is too extensive. How do I do this? Yeah. So that, you know, even we use Wikipedia reluctantly.
Yeah. As a starting point, to as a bouncing off point. But again, it's also been really difficult. Usually I always try to find the like original source of things. And with this, it's also just been impossible to find the original sources of things, the original historic records, the oldest tool, because there's so much chaos, it seems, in the record, that it's difficult to know when things started and how things developed. And there's so much that happens all over the world in between. But I will say that for the next couple of episodes where we're going to look at spoons and forks and chopsticks, then there'll be a little bit more kind of regulation to it, hopefully, because there's a bit more. Yeah, we hope. We can see. But anyway, we hope that you enjoyed this little tea break and now can have some little fun facts that you tell your friends when you're spreading butter on your toast next time at breakfast. If you enjoyed it, please do like, follow, subscribe, etc. wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic, you can find all of the links and contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.